Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Would you please welcome Columbia recording artist, Bob Dylan.
Take my future on a hell of a path. Look like tomorrow is coming on fast. I ain't complaining about what I got. Seen better days, but who has not? Soon you, soon it'll go. My back to beat up, my heart don't go. Soon you, I got to go.
Hello and welcome to Never Ending Stories, a podcast about Bob Dylan and the Never Ending Tour. I'm Ian.
I'm Evan.
And I'm Steve.
And today's show is Woodstock 94, Bob Dylan Live at Woodstock. The band is Bob Dylan, Bucky Baxter, John J.J. Jackson, Winston Watson, and Tony Garnier. And this choice was made not by the three of us, but by the very first guest of Never Ending Stories. It's Ezra Koenig. Ezra, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Pleasure's all ours.
Why did you pick it? Why did you do it?
Well, when I was very honored to be invited on the program, and I was thinking about this a lot. Why did I pick this show? I certainly wasn't there, and I've been reflecting on that. One is that I just had it like bookmarked. Because I'd watched it like a couple of times, and the full show is on YouTube, so it's got that going for it. Professionally shot, and then it was funny just thinking about it more. I realized like 1994 was a Dylan year that I've kind of just been interested in, I realized I'd had this big obsession last year with Bob Dylan's Greatest Hits Volume 3. On my show, Time Crisis, we did a two-part deep dive just on that.
And then great episodes.
Thank you. That was our little taste of the J-Man world. And then I was thinking about it, and I was like, oh yeah, when did that come out? And it was November 94. And then on the flip side, there's this performance I bet some of you guys have seen that's also on YouTube that's before Woodstock, which was in August 94. It was in May 94. And Bob's playing with an orchestra in Nara, Japan.
It's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart ring in a bar. What did you see?
I'd weirdly come across that performance just because I was like searching for different versions of A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. And in like a weird coincidence, I was in Japan a lot last year, and I went to that place where he played because it's a very famous destination. I'm almost surprised that they did a show there because it's this famous temple, Todaiji, that has like this really like remarkable huge brass Buddha inside it. And the temple itself is really remarkable. Anyway, it was like this weird coincidence that I was there, and I was like, wait, is this where Bob did that like intense orchestral performance? So anyway, I felt like I was being drawn to 1994 Bob. And then on top of that, I was born in 1984. So, you know, there's a way in which, you know, your earliest memories, a lot of people are like, you know, 3 or 4 years old. There's something about when you're 10, you're really like coming online. You know, so 94 always kind of felt like a big year for me. I turned 10. I received a cassette copy of In Utero for my birthday. And then I went to school 2 days later and found out Kurt had died. It was like I started to feel like I was thinking about music and culture and stuff. Mm. So anyway, I was naturally drawn to Woodstock 94 and Bob's performance and the whole year, really.
I just want to say that I'm really glad that Ezra picked this show because I'd never listened to the show before, and I think I always assumed that it wouldn't be very good because it's a festival show. There's a weird history with Bob Dylan and Woodstock. You know, like the original Woodstock in 1969, one of the reasons why it was in upstate New York was that it was in proximity to where Bob Dylan lived at the time, and that's where the band was. And there was this idea that, like, if we do Woodstock near where Bob Dylan lives, then maybe he'll come play Woodstock, which of course didn't happen. He actually ended up playing the Isle of Wight Festival in England, which was the same weekend, and it seemed like a very deliberate, like, rebuke of Woodstock, that not only is he not going to play Woodstock, he's going to, like,
flee the country the same weekend
and play, like, another massive festival with the band. So I just thought, like, well, if he's playing Woodstock in 1994, you know, it must be a cash grab. And it's funny because, like Evan shared, like, a tweet thread where I forget who was tweeting about this, but it was talking about how, like, they wanted Neil Young to play Woodstock and he turned it down. And then when Bob found out what, like, how much money Neil Young was offered,
suddenly Bob Dylan is, like, down to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
That is kind of the drama with it for me. Like, from the outside, it's kind of like, well, is it a little sad that Bob Dylan has capitulated to big Woodstock and he's playing the festival now? And it might be that he did just want to take a big payday, but also he did it nobly. I think he performed and held up his end of the bargain well, and probably better than anybody would have expected.
Listening to this show, and I've listened to it several times, I'm continually amazed, and not to spoil, like, we'll get into this as we talk about the set, I was, like, amazed by, like, how good this is. Like, there are so many highlights here that you wouldn't necessarily expect just looking at the set list, because it's a very stock set list. And Ezra, you know, it's interesting you're talking about, like, how you're obsessed with, like, Greatest Hits Volume 3, which came out in 94. This was also the year that Dylan did MTV Unplugged, which was a very Greatest Hits type set on that record. Although I think MTV Unplugged, I think his performance is great, actually. I love that album, and especially if you dig into the expanded outtakes from that, it's really good. But just looking at the album itself, I think it's great. Dignity never been photographed. But this does seem like a year, like, where Dylan was reintroducing himself to, like, a younger generation, playing his hits, but not phoning it in, doing it, like, really well. Like, we joke on this show about, like, how every Dylan show has, like, All on the Watchtower and Rainy Day Women and these sort of stock songs, and that's in this Woodstock set. But I'm like, wow, I love hearing Rainy Day Women in this Woodstock 94 set. I never thought I would say that. Like, there's so many songs that you feel like you've heard a million times that he finds a way to deliver in a really exciting way.
And a lot of that is to the band's credit and just the way that they're playing, kind of, like, pretty close to the spirit of those original 60s instrumentals. But amped up and kind of, like, slightly alt-countryed out at times. And it just works really well.
I just want to give some context here for this Woodstock 94 performance. This was the third day of the festival, played on the north stage. There was also a south stage at Woodstock 94. And on Sunday, this was Sunday, August 14th, one of the more iconic performances from Woodstock 94 was Green Day. You know, where there was all this mud at the festival, yeah, and they were throwing, right, like, mud and stuff, you know, sort of, like, really leaning into, like, the dirtiness of it. Green Day was on the south stage on the 14th.
Oh, and what is this fucking free hippie love shit? How you doing, all you rich motherfuckers?
So that was going on the opposite stage of Bob Dylan. I just, like, want to read the performers that were on the north stage, because I think it reflects the combination of, like, 60s people and also, like, 90s people that were trying to revive the 60s at that time. So you have Country Joe, of Country Joe and the Fish.
This is a song I wrote for Greenpeace Foundation about 10 years ago. It's called Save the Whales.
You have Arrested Development. You have the Allman Brothers Band. You have Traffic. You have the Spin Doctors, who I feel like were sort of past their peak at this point. Porno for Pyros. The Red Hot Chili Peppers. And Peter Gabriel. So this is like who Bob is rubbing shoulders with.
Wow.
And I was wondering about this too, because in the broadcast on YouTube, I don't know if that was from MTV or what, they say, you know, coming up on the North Stage, we got Red Hot Chili Peppers and Peter Gabriel. So does that imply that the organizers made a decision? Does that mean that Peter Gabriel was the headliner? You know, did they make a decision that they were like, you know, Peter, his music's a little more relevant right now. Bob, he can get that nice sunset slot, but then we're going to bring the energy up with the Chili Peppers. And was Peter Gabriel getting more of a legend status VIP treatment in 94? Or do I have it wrong?
Apparently, Bob was actually like an hour and a half late to his set. So whatever the schedule was supposed to be, Bob himself ended up just completely fucking it up and throwing a wrench into things.
So he was even later.
That sounds intentional.
Yeah, I think so. That's a big dick
generally, move. You know, just generally with a festival, you kind of, there can be exceptions, but generally like the later somebody's playing, like that's the headliner, and every step backwards was a deliberate decision on the promoter's part. Or a thoughtful decision about who they thought would be like a big draw or who they wanted to give like pride of place. Not that it can be great to play during the daytime, but you know what I mean? Why wouldn't they give Bob the headliner status? Was it so obvious? I mean, come on, Bob, you're not Peter Gabriel. It's 1994.
It is important to remember like what the context is for where Bob's career is at, because at this point, 94, this is like a really interesting place in regards to that, because he hasn't put out Time Out of Mind yet. The last album is Under the Red Sky. Handy dandy, if every bone in his body was a broken, he would never admit it. And Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong.
Red Sky's last.
Under the Red Sky's the last originals.
Full record. Right, exactly.
And so like it is kind of this this foggy area where I think people were not totally sure if he would really be back as like, you know, nobody could have anticipated like the full on comeback mode that he would be in. But this was, I think, a moment of him kind of ramping up. Maybe he could tell that was going to happen, or personally, he was like, the fact that he was willing to do this has maybe says something about like his creative energies like coalescing again.
Mm.
But yeah, maybe it wasn't so clear to the promoters like that he was really going to be like burning the house down.
I think they just wanted to get people out of there, because that's part of the Woodstock 94 thing. It was this unmitigated disaster, a complete clusterfuck. They sold 150,000 tickets. 350,000 people showed up somehow. The fences around the venue collapsed. It was just a mud nightmare.
But like by Woodstock standards, like not that big of a disaster. Like there's the bigger disaster coming.
Not as bad as 99.
Because just to circle back to like what Ezra was saying, I mean, because this was something that I was trying to figure out. I was trying to find like a schedule for this day. Like, do we know that Gabriel was the headliner? Because I was trying to figure out, like, is it the Chili Peppers? Because I feel like commercially, they would have been the bigger band.
So Frusciante didn't play 90. Was this when they did like Light Bulb Heads? It was kind
exactly. They did Light Bulb Heads. Get to me, sweet sickness. Y'all not what made you suck my kiss. Because the Chili Peppers also played 99, Woodstock 99, and that's like when they were back with Frusciante. But maybe Gabriel would have been the headliner?
Well, no, because Bob, remember, Bob, it's from that fact, right? Bob was the Neil, replacement for the 600K payday, and Neil was going to be the headliner. I can almost guarantee that this was just Bob was like, I'm not coming out later than like 6 p.m. or something. I got to get on the bus, because this was in the middle of a tour. This was a 20-date tour.
Yeah. Well, and I can tell you something from personal experience, that in at Fuji Rock Festival in Japan in 2018, we got the invitation from the organizers to be second from the top on the main stage, and Bob was going to headline. Of course, like, oh, this is going to rule. And then way before the show, like months early, manager said, are you guys cool with swapping like set times with Bob? He wants to get out of there. It's like months before. So we're like, sure, but also, and it was kind of late. Like, I could totally understand. I mean, but of course, you know, this is in 2018, so Bob is 24 years older, you know, in his late, he's pushing 80, then I could totally understand why he might feel like, I'm not going to get on stage at 10 p.m. and then be like, well, but Bob, you're the headline. He's like, I'm still the headline. I don't care. So we got to play after him, but, you know, of course, he was still the headliner on the poster. Is it possible he was still pulling that move in 94? Maybe.
I could see it. That sounds like a Bob thing to me.
He's in his mid-50s, and he's just like, I want to beat traffic. And also, it is, you can kind of feel, you can feel the energy, even just watching the show or listening to it, that he does have that beautiful sunset slot, which is so nice. You know, like, you can tell he comes out, there's still a little bit of sunlight, it's cooling off, the sun's going down. Like, I bet when he kind of like switched over to the acoustic set, it was probably like one of those like awesome moments at a show where like it's finally nighttime and then like, oh, here comes the acoustic moment. I bet that felt so good. So maybe he also just wisely chose the better, a cooler slot in a way.
He's just sitting there like silently in his bus or trailer backstage and just like, the moment's not right. It's not the right moment. Mm-hmm. And then he raises his hand.
Like, do you think Kiedis came in to his trailer and was like, hey, Bob, do you want to trade? Like, because we'll trade with you. Like Kiedis has the light bulb already on his head. And he's like, already? Maybe he's like, hey.
Shirtless.
We have this light bulb aesthetic going on. It'd be better if it was darker for us.
Can't be doing that during the day.
We need it. Yeah, we need nighttime to make these things shine. Well, I don't want to dwell on it because it has nothing to do with Bob, but I am curious, did Peter Gabriel headline over the Chili Peppers in 94?
And that's the thing I was trying to figure out.
That's a great question.
Did he get paid more than the Chili Peppers?
Well, because Us, which was the most recent Peter Gabriel record, is definitely not a bigger record than Blood Sugar Sex Magik, but then you have the So energy. Maybe there's that thing like where it just carries over, and also you have to factor in the promoters at Woodstock 99 or 94 are older, so maybe they would defer to Gabriel. So I don't know. I if I had to put money down, I'd probably say maybe Gabriel was the headliner.
This is a sick track list. I mean, those live record, the one with all those Us cuts. Mm.
Secret World. Oh, yeah.
If you listen to that, it'd be hard for me to see that as anything but a headliner, because like that Come Talk to Me at the beginning is like, it sounds like Lion King. It's crazy. It's like huge.
So he was crushing it live. He probably had like 20 people on stage. Just
right. It's a full on like James Cameron level epic. Like he really is the James Cameron of rock music.
I totally see that. Oh, please talk to me. Won't you please come talk to me? Just like it used to be.
You were talking a little bit about your festival playing experience. I'm just curious, as the closest thing to Bob Dylan that we have on this podcast right now.
Oh dear!
If you could give us that perspective, because to me as a listener, I just feel like I wouldn't expect a great performance at a festival.
One thing I was definitely curious about, and you know, was what were the shows around Woodstock 94 like? And when you look through, you're like, oh, of course, 1994, Bob was like touring his ass off. He didn't do a particularly special set list for Woodstock. And in fact, I was kind of surprised because, you know, in the live music business with festivals, one of the things that's always getting talked about is radius clauses. How close can you play to the festival? You know, like famous example would be Coachella paying somebody a whole bunch of money to play Coachella. they're not going to let you play a big LA right. show. You know, if you're, they, I'm sure if, I don't know, even who plays Coachella, you know, I'm sure if Blackpink said, we want to do a couple nights at the Troubadour, get people talking, that's fine. But they couldn't go play a crypto.com arena in LA and then go do Staples Center. They could probably let them play San Francisco, but anyway, Radius Clauses, it's a whole thing. And I was like, look like Bob was playing a whole bunch of shows in upstate New York. Maybe back then they were just like, whatever you want to do, Bob. He was touring like New England pretty hard then. So anyway, I find sometimes festivals can throw you off your game if they're, you know, kind of like a one-off or something. You often don't get a sound check, could be a little bit nervous going in, but this kind of feels like, you know, the band was playing a lot. So maybe they felt like Woodstock was just another gig. I'm sure the energy is going to be different because it's not their own headline gig, but they probably felt fresh. The crew's dialed in, the band's dialed in, no major surprises. So maybe they felt pretty confident going in, I would assume. But yeah, festivals can be, you definitely have to be thoughtful about festivals. And, you know, it's a very interesting thing that you end up like talking about with your team. And, you know, I'm lucky to work with like some live music people who like, they obsess about the details. And so, you know, sometimes you get an offer, of course, you're concerned about the money. Can we get everybody there? But also these little things like where you fall on the bill, who's playing before you, who's playing after you, what's the audience going to be like? So for instance, I couldn't help but just like my dude in a band brain when I was thinking about Peter Gabriel getting the headline offer, and I'm a big Peter Gabriel fan, I was kind of like, yeah, that's cool. I'm glad that Peter got that 94 headline slot. But then my next thought was, I hope the crowd didn't shrink after RHCP, because that's a double-edged sword. Like, you know, we've gotten a couple like headline offers where you're kind of like, eh. You know, and there's, I don't want to be negative, but like, you know, when you really sit down with people who work in live music, they have a million examples of, oh yeah, they headlined that big festival, big mistake, because half the crowd left and they got that one big payday, didn't headline a lot of festivals after that one. So, you know, these are all these like funny things. I'd hope when Bob was in his mid-50s, he was just like, let's get the show on the road. I'll play Woodstock 94. I'll play a dive bar. You know, hopefully he was beyond all this. But definitely all these things, I'm sure his manager and his booking agent were thinking about all these things. Like, how is it going to feel for Bob? What's the audience going to think? What's the atmosphere going to be like? Who's playing on the South stage? Is it going to be like, there's all sorts of legendary stories like that. Lollapalooza, they have those two big stages playing at the same time. There's some, like, legendary bad ones where it's like, man, 90% of the crowd went to go see that artist and 10%. So yeah, I do find festivals are very fascinating in terms of how, yeah, you have so much less control over how things might feel. So was Bob putting a lot of thought into this? I really wonder.
Well, the one quote we have on that subject from the man himself is when asked, was playing at Woodstock a special moment? Bob Dylan said, nah, it was just another show, really. We just blew in and blew out of there. You do wonder if you're coming across because you feel so small on a stage like that.
Going back to the David Lynch, the itsy bitsy Bob Dylan.
Then Bob Dylan came out on the stage and I couldn't believe how little he was. And I measured him with my fingers on my knee, and I said to her, his jeans are only this big.
You don't want to do that to an audience, make yourself appear the size of a
thumbtack,
a thimble.
How'd the crowd look compared to Bob's crowd when you guys came on after him, Ezra?
We held them. But I also have to say, we were in famously one of the most polite countries on earth.
They felt like they were stuck there. They got
Would that have happened in upstate New York? I don't know.
Not with this crowd, at least. Full of fucking people died at this show. I just like, I'm endlessly fascinated with all this Woodstock lore.
Yeah, I'm sure it was.
There were
wild.
Three deaths. One from diabetes complications. One unknown. At least I don't know. And the third from a ruptured spleen. I know this is like the tame 90s Woodstock or whatever compared to 99, right. But like it still sounds just like a completely insane.
Well, that sounds like a typical year at Glastonbury.
Yeah.
When you get that many people together.
I guess that's true.
Oh, and sorry, just one other thing I'll say about the wonderful Fuji Rock crowd, which is a really beautiful festival up in the mountains, is that then we got an official headline offer a few years later. Maybe Bob helped us by showing that we could play. We could be the last band on stage this past summer. And we closed the show with Joker Man, and our version's about 10 or 11 minutes. This is all our bassist, Chris Bayo. He makes a lot of the big calls for the set list. He has a lot of great ideas. He's like, we should end with that because, you know, last time we played after Bob Dylan. We should end with like a tribute to Bob. And I was like, we've done it a couple times, but I was like, last song at a festival, it's not our song. Like, it's kind of long, Joker Man. And he's like, I think this crowd will be down for it. And that's when I really knew that was Fuji Rock crowd's one of the best, because nobody was walking away, even though I'm sure half of them were not familiar with the song. Just like, why are these guys like playing this weird song I've never heard for this long? And that was our closer, and everybody stayed.
Great pick.
It's an incredible version. I love it.
Oh, thanks. Oh, wait, I got to tell you something. It was wild, but Jake Longstreth got an email today, which he forwarded to me, from a guy who said, hey, Jake, just a message for you and the guys. I visited Tulsa this past week to catch Springsteen. And while I was there, I had to make sure I went to the Bob Dylan Center, famously in Tulsa. And then he sent all these pictures, and there was like a Joker Man exhibit, like an exhibit about the song. I don't know what's happening at really? The Bob. Have any of you guys been to the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa?
Not many yet.
Oh, we got to get there.
You're the closest, Steven. You can take a hop, skip, and a jump down there.
I'm not that close, though. It's like Oklahoma.
We're not going till we're invited.
Right, yeah, fair enough.
Until they tell us.
Do you guys have any idea? Well, anyway, I was kind of surprised that there's like exhibits, because I wondered if it's more like a research facility for like, what's that guy's name? Like Clint Halen? Or whatever, to go there with like gloves for 2 weeks and like
pour. Exactly.
Anyway, I'll send you guys these pictures, but it was like a Joker Man exhibit where it's like four different versions of the single from around the world, original lyrics, and then there was a little you know, like you have at a museum, a little plaque with some write up with some information, and in it they talked about the song continues to occasionally reappear on Dylan's set list. And its influence endures. This I had no idea about. Coldplay's Chris Martin marvels. How can this guy have a song that comes from this other world? And it's still so brilliant. I had no idea that Chris Martin was a Joker Man song fan. And then it said, Vampire Weekend makes a cover of the song a highlight of their 2019 tour. We were very touched by that.
That's beautiful.
There's certainly a reason why there is a designated Joker Man section.
Well, you guys as well. they know that the under 40 crowd is getting excited about a little song off Infidels. And maybe we should do an exhibit.
I think Joker Man is the international language. Hopefully, there should be like a Jam Flow Man, I think, reference in there as well. But, you know, let's not get greedy. I think at some point, though, there needs to be a Jam Flow Man, Joker Man.
Into Joker Man.
Yeah. Beautiful.
But I was interested, too, when I was looking, just clicking around on setlist.fm. And also, another thing I didn't realize, but I was so drawn to 94. 94 is the Joker Man year.
That's right.
Far and away. I mean, I'm sure you guys have covered this in some capacity, but I had no idea. I was like, 94 is the year he played Joker Man more than any year. More than any year in the 80s.
Yeah.
The big Joker Man year.
I was born in 1994. I was born November 94, the year that...
The month Greatest Hits, Volume 3.
Or the month. The month.
Wow.
So I feel like maybe I was born under a Joker moon. the Nightingale's Tune.
That's right.
We just talked about you closing your Fuji Rock Festival set with Joker Man. So I think now is the time when we talk about this show and Bob opening Woodstock 94.
Yes.
We waited 25 years to hear this. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bob Dylan.
Thank you.
We've waited 25 years for this, you know, for Joker.
I love that. Just there's something that's so funny about that. The announcer says we waited 25 years for this. It's funny watching it now because you're like, oh right, it's in some people's minds, it was like they were finally seeing Bob Dylan at Woodstock. It barely makes any sense. It's like, all right, you know, he's kind of there. But there's something so funny about you could totally picture if they're making this thing like you missed him in the 60s, but here we are together 25 years later. And you could totally imagine him kicking off with like, bam, 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 and like people go like, ah, but instead, just standing on the wall.
Well, that leads right to our first segment.
You know, you're in for a good set when he comes out with Joker Man at Woodstock. As crowd-pleasing as some of it does get towards the end of the set, I mean, you gotta give him props for that. And just, like, the way it rolls in with Winston on the drums is, like, absolutely... This 94, like, live version seems to me like the one... I don't know if you guys, like, listened to a bunch of different Joker Men, you know, gearing up for integrating it into your sets, Ezra, but like this longer, jammier kind of like all-over version seems like the closest reference point for what you guys ended up doing with it in the Vampire Weekend shows.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, mostly when I saw Arlan as just being trying to do the most faithful live version of the studio recording. Because I was just kind of, I saw that like, oh, okay, Built to Spill used to play it all the time. Standing on the water, catching your breath. And their version's like a little noisy, and then there's so many amazing Bob versions. But yeah, this is kind of like one of the jammier moments in the whole thing. And maybe some of like the most beautiful moments. Like also, that's kind of what hooked me. I was like, oh, I think when I first watched this, I was like, oh, Joker Man opener, sick. And then, you know, it opens up and it's kind of like jarring and intense. And then, yeah, as it opens up towards the end and the pedal steel moments, there's like some real moments where you're like, everybody's noodling a little bit. And you could really start to see how this could have been like a 20-minute thing.
Oh, man. If only it could have been.
Already a truncated set and then there's just like a third of it is just Joker Man. That would have been fine.
Why did you not play this with the Dead any of those shows?
That's a great question. And maybe Jerry just wasn't into Joker Man. Although Jerry always had like a great taste for digging out lost classics in Bob Dylan's back catalog.
Senor.
Senor. Senor.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Senor.
The way that the song functions, though, it almost feels like Dylan's tribute to the Dead, like after the fact. Mm. It feels like he uses it as that. And especially right around here. I don't know. There's when you're talking about like how the song kind of actually has all these beautiful moments, even when it's played hard, that is something about it that I think really comes across here, where it's like this song really is, even like the Plugs version that was our theme song, like the
Letterman
one, like that's like this LA punk style one, and the song just is beautiful. Like it just like kind of has this serenity at its core somehow. And I thought your version was really great for the way that like trying to do something closer to the original version. It seems like there's something about the song that makes you want to expand on it in some way. And I think Dylan also seems to be like falling into that. And it's great. It's like a fractal type song. It just kind of goes and goes.
Yeah, totally. No, yeah, I think it wants to be long and the verses want to be like kind of poured over. I really like when we were kind of busting it out again last year after not having played much during COVID, I also found I just enjoyed playing it because I just kind of like being immersed in the lyrics. Mm. And by doing like kind of a longer version, any musician, I played a million shows where I'm just like full autopilot, like zoned out, thinking about mundane stuff and like snap back in. But there is something about Joker Man when we're playing it, I do, because there's space and you can take space between the verses, I do find myself like really pondering the lyrics in like a deeper way than sometimes I even do when I'm just listening to it at home, just like really just like on stage, like thinking about it. What did he mean? What did he mean by that? And there is a Joker Man energy, you know, we could,
that's right.
People could debate till the cows come home. Who is Joker Man? what does the Joker Man archetype represent? But we all have some kind of personal feeling that there's a vibe in the song and in the name and whatever this character is. It can be hard to describe, but yeah, it means something. Maybe it is some funny mix of hard and serene. I mean, it's the Joker Man.
Yeah.
Joke Man. The man, you know.
When he was playing it so much in 94, what's interesting about it to me is that, you know, the original recording on Infidels, you know, he's recording with Sly and Robbie. It has this sort of like reggae feel to it. And then in 94, it's a much more sort of rocky type song. And Winston Watson, the drummer in the band at the time, has talked about how Bob really wanted to be more rocky. In this time, because, you know, it was the time of grunge. I think he wanted to compete with that. He could see Neil Young was, you know, collaborating with Pearl Jam, and like he wanted to have his own equivalent to that. Getting ready to record this episode, I watched a very terrible but very entertaining documentary, the Winston Watson documentary that you can watch on Tubi. I recommend anyone listening to this watching this.
Bob Dylan turns around to me and he says, "Sit down, Winnie." I thought, oh my God, now I've done it. I've made Bob Dylan mad. And he puts a cigarette out and he stands up and he says, "Winston is here because he has a certain vibe. I want that vibe. I'm not getting that vibe. We're going to start playing some music in here or everybody goes home."
He talks about this performance specifically in that movie. And he says, like, before they walked out, Winston and Bob Dylan had a cigarette on the side of the stage, and Bob pulled Winston aside and he said, "You make me feel really confident out there. I feel like we can do anything."
Well,
I feel like I can do anything when I'm out there.
Oh, wow.
And like Winston was in tears when he started playing the song. So like, if you listen to the Joker Man, like the Joker Man performance, there's like a little weird thing at the beginning of the song, like where he kind of screws up like a little bit, and it's because he was crying. He was like distracted because Bob was really sweet to him before playing the song.
Wow.
Oh my god. That's the nicest thing I've ever heard, anecdotally or otherwise, Bob Dylan say to anyone.
How amazing is that?
Beautiful.
I know, like, that he would pull Winston aside before playing this huge show and be like, "Hey man, like, you make me feel really confident out there, and I appreciate you."
Okay, Bob Dylan is not immune to like Woodstock magic, to like the drama of these moments.
Yeah,
he's like,
exactly.
he'll deny it forever. It was nothing special. Yeah, we just went in and played. But like, if that's true, he was
right.
He was the tenderest.
You know,
he's
no
ever
knock
been
on him, but I'm sure he sometimes goes weeks without talking to some of the band members. You know, like
probably on the bus. Just
yeah,
like, just passing.
He's in
them.
His own world, so I'm sure that was like really meaningful for him to like step out and say that. Didn't. Yeah, clearly.
That's beautiful.
Maybe Bob, he was a little nervous going into his big Woodstock performance.
I bet he was. You know, you see him up there on that video, and he's kind of like, you know, he gets more comfortable on stage, I think, as the video goes on. You just watch the whole thing on YouTube. It's all up there for free. But at the beginning, he seems a little kind of like tenuous. But over time, I think he ends up really kind of leaning into the performance. One other note that I think is just amazing, and maybe it's because we get a little bit more video evidence of this show than we typically have for the shows that we talk about, but Bob is a lead guitarist
for
this set.
Yeah.
He's like, he's shredding right there with John Jackson, the main guitar player.
The blues assassin.
On the electric guitar. Not the blues. You keep doing this.
Oh,
Steve
I was
Kimball
thinking
the blues
of,
assassin.
Wait, I thought JJ no. Jackson was the blues assassin.
No.
All
no.
right.
Steve
I always
Kimball
want to call JJ
assassin.
Jackson the blues assassin.
Sounds better.
We got to get a master Wikipedia document going for all the terrible nicknames that we have for all these guys. But, you know, Bob himself is being a blues assassin right up there, shredding on the guitar in a really kind of uncommon way, as far as I can tell. Like, I don't really think of him as like a lead electric guitarist, especially at this moment in time. But I think, again, something about the Woodstock magic just made him want to like do that and be up on stage and shred.
And also the way he's dressed. I mean, he definitely did that on purpose. Like, the way he's dressed is so classic, so iconically Bob.
He looks like Johnny Cash.
Well, he looks like Bob Dylan in like 1966. Mm. He's just wearing like a high lapel black suit and a white collar. I guess he's, does he have a tie or is it a, like a pussy?
It's one of those Western neckties. Yeah. It's like a silk little bow tie.
Yeah. It's, I mean, he looks like so iconic and classic. He's got the harmonica holder and, mm-hmm. I think that was probably intentional too. Like, maybe I won't just wear a hoodie this time.
Or you think about the way that he was dressed, like, during the Isle of Wight Festival during the original Woodstock, and he's in that all-white, like, leisure suit, and he's got his shitty little beard and the short cropped hair.
He looks great.
He looks amazing there, but he doesn't look like 66 Bob Dylan, and this really does seem like he's, like, trying to conjure the memory of what once was.
Well, and also, you guys will know more about this, because I only kind of glanced at some other 94 set lists, but just looking at this one alone, it was interesting to see that got the Joker Man opener, and then he dropped God Knows. Other than that, every single song is from the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was apparently pretty common for the shows around that time.
That was the vibe.
Yeah. I think he was kind of bringing back a lot of the 60s material from what I've seen.
This episode of Joker Man Podcast is presented by DistroKid. Over a million artists rely on DistroKid to distribute their music and get it into all of the places it needs to go, your Spotify's, your Apple Music's, your YouTube's, your TikTok's, your Tidal's, your Instagram's, and any other streaming service of note. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy, with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100%, that's right, 100, all of them, folks, of their royalties and earnings. DistroKid comes with tons of great features, including Mixia, which allows DistroKid users to put the finishing touches on their tracks in just minutes, getting a customizable and polished end result that anyone can feel confident in before sharing it with the world. The DistroKid app is available now on iOS and Android, so go to the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store to download it today. This is the one show during this run, at least, that doesn't have Tangled in it during the acoustic set, for what that's worth. I think some of the other shows did also have like a few more deeper-ish cuts, like Man in the Long Black Coat pops up here and there, You're a Big Girl Now pops up, In the Garden pops up.
In the Garden.
But this, I mean, yeah, that's even deeper.
He likes In the Garden.
He does like In the Garden.
He said it's like one of his best songs.
I like In the Garden. But yeah, I mean, I think it's the same way that it was a pretty clear choice on his part, like when he did the old Cella thing in 2016, that was like almost all kind of just like classic shit. Like, I think there was an element of him trying to give these people what they came for. Mm-hmm.
Although, like I was saying earlier, he is doing like a greatest hits set, which on paper seems pretty boring. But then what he is actually doing musically in the show ends up being like really surprisingly exciting. Like, and I have to say that for me, the highlight of this show is the It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, which I think is like one of my all-time favorite versions of this song. And I can't believe I'm saying that. You have Tony Garnier doing like the John Cale like cello drone.
He's got the bow out. Yeah. No, it's kind of like dirgy. Planting the seeds for Murder Most Foul.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But I'm a to keep you in a grand fashion.
got the saints coming through. And it's all over now, baby blue. The highway is for gamblers, but I use yourself.
I would second that, basically. I definitely think Baby Blue is like one of the great moments, if not like the best moment of the whole show. It's such an achievement to get that to work on in that context and have it feel like intimate to that many people.
The whole acoustic set is a triumph. I think we feel like we're coming back to that kind of concept often in a lot of the shows that we talk about, but like Don't Think Twice, Masters of War, Baby Blue, and then it ends with It Ain't Me, Babe. Those are the four acoustic numbers.
Right.
Fucking amazing. And it seems ballsy to me to go up on stage at a place like this that he knows is just a shit pit out there with all these crazy, drunk, dying people. And just play acoustic songs,
yeah.
Especially an 8-minute acoustic version of Baby Blue. There aren't even like video boards on the side of the stage, you know, because it's a show from 30 years ago or something. It you know, it feels kind of like a tightrope a walk at a certain point, but he totally pulls it off.
It's funny that you guys love that one so much because I thought it was really cool, but I also had this feeling watching it that he maybe the audience was with him the least. During the long Baby Blue, just like, you know, you could hear a few people talking. You're never sure, just like, you know, what mics you're hearing. I wonder what it was like there, but it is, I agree, very ballsy, super cool. Like, Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. I think people were, I don't know, you feel like the people were psyched. It's such, right. It was so feel good. The Buggy Baxter playing mandolin. It's just like Sundown, Bob Dylan at Woodstock. It sounds good. Everybody knows the song. That probably felt so perfect.
What have you done? Used to sit and wonder why, babe. Even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe. You don't matter anyhow. When you reach the crow, it's at the break of dawn. Look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm traveling on. Don't think twice, it's alright.
Yeah. Somebody on the comments on YouTube here says, I watched this from the bleachers on the right side of the stage. The sun was setting in pink and purple. You could hear him clearly. The crowd was absolutely silent all the way through. Just magical, simple and majestic. What an evening. Maybe it seemed like the crowd was quiet when you were there.
Might have been a few people up front. You could kind of hear them during Baby Blue. That was a really... When you listen like Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, Masters of War, you kind of wonder... Could he have just come out and done a full acoustic set?
100%.
With the guys. Well, it sounds so good with the mandolin and the bass.
Ain't no use in calling out my name, babe. Like you never did before. And it ain't no use in calling out my name, babe. I can't hear you anymore. I'm a-thinking in a water man and walking all the way down the road.
And that Masters of War is like pretty short. It's like about 5 minutes long, which I think by Masters of War standards is like pretty, you know, frisky. You know, I feel like that can be pretty long.
It's a frisky Masters of War.
And I watch while you're alone down to your deathbed. And I'll stand hand over your grave, and I'm sure that you're dead.
I think your point, Ezra, is totally on about, I feel like if I was in like a mud pit, I would not want to hear a drony, it's all over now, baby blue. I feel like that'd probably be tough, which is why like another highlight of this set for me is the God Knows that comes after that, which I think is so kick-ass. Like that's probably like my other favorite performance from the set. Like, the droney, It's All Over Now Baby Blue, and then you get like this awesome God Knows, like where, you know, the Bob's playing the electric for about half the song, and then when like the drums come in the middle, and it just sounds so
big
good.
Moment.
It was supposed to last the season, but it been so strong for so long. God knows.
God Knows has that cool like built-in build, and it like launches off.
And I bet, I'm wrong. I'm looking at the other set list around this time. I was gonna say this is a Sunday show. I bet Bob was playing God Knows because it's a Sunday show, because he was doing that in 2004.
Really?
Yeah. Remember that show you picked, Evan, where it started with God Knows?
That was a
Sunday show. Yeah.
I didn't know that was a thing.
That's his Sunday song.
One of our patrons, Tim.
It's like, well, it's Sunday.
Yeah. Shout out Tim. He told us every show that he played that year that was on a Sunday started with God Knows.
Wow.
And I guess he was playing God Knows on other nights as well. But I like to think of, it's the seventh day he rests type of pick here at Woodstock.
I hope so.
Yeah. It Ain't Me, Babe, also just got to shout it out one more time in terms of the stuff that we dig. Like, this 94 version and 95 is like one of my all-time versions of any song ever. And this is a song that, like, you know, I think has become one of Bob's defining tracks, and he loves to play. It's one of his most played, and kind of fucks with it often the way that he does with Tangled, although not quite to the extent like switching verses around and writing new lyrics. But the way that he's just living in this world, in this sound, and closes everything on this like really stately and austere kind of rendition of this song is, I mean, that's, again, that's magic
great.
To me.
Was that a typical closer in this era?
I think it was. It was often It Ain't Me, Babe. I'm looking at the other shows around this time. Actually, yes, literally every show was closing.
Okay, so we shouldn't read any special meaning into him saying goodbye to the Woodstock 94 Nation with It Ain't Me, Babe.
No, but it is still great, even just that, you know, technically that happened. And I think that's the type of thing that can't help but cross anybody's mind when they're like really invested in Dylan and he happens to be playing Woodstock. Like, it is great that it ends with It Ain't Me, Babe.
Opening with Joker Man and ending with It Ain't Me, Babe, you could concoct
a whole
story
fucking
about
thing there.
Yeah. And just like that melancholy arrangement, I really like that version versus like the more 60s like tell off type feel that it had, like the more scaring.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it feels more painful. I really like when the song has a little bit more of that feeling of like it being kind of difficult emotionally. It's more effective for me than when it's just kind of like in the same realm as like Positively 4th Street or something.
Yeah. Totally.
It feels a little bit heavy when you maybe didn't expect it to.
If we're going to transition to Oh Mercy.
Oh Mercy.
The more sort of critical section, I think that's where we're going here. You know, we were talking about the intro of the show, and my only Oh Mercy moment of the show is the introduction, because it comes from John Cher. He's the one who says, "We've been waiting 25 years for Bob Dylan to play here." And John Cher was the promoter of Woodstock 94. He's also the promoter of Woodstock 99. And that's how he came into my life, like when I was interviewing him. And, you know, Cher is a very interesting character because, you know, he has been described as like the Bill Graham of the East Coast. Like, he was the Grateful Dead's promoter, basically, on the East Coast. Like, he booked a ton of huge East Coast shows. For the 36 from the Vault listeners out there, the Dick's Picks 15, that's the show in 1977 in New Jersey. It's like September.
Oh, English Town?
English Town, yes. Thank you, Ezra.
Dad, we got another Deadhead on the show.
Is that the one with the big return of is that when who was like had just been injured in a car accident?
That was Mickey.
Mickey's like first show back, and it was massive.
Yeah, and at the start of that show, John Cher introduces that show. So, like, he's a big part of that world. So he's an important, like, concert promoter and all that, but I still, in my mind, associate him with Woodstock 99. So to hear him introduce this show, maybe that's, like, the one sour note of this, if I had one Oh Mercy moment, because I don't think there's any musical moments for me otherwise here that I don't really like. Other than, like, I don't need to hear All Along the Watchtower again.
Watchtower Watch is our a segment we're running into right now.
There must be some way out of here.
Is the song All Along the Watchtower in the show? Yes.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
And it's almost always.
That's the joke.
Sometimes it isn't, and then we have to say no.
Right.
But it often is, and it's often the third song.
That was his go-to.
Yeah.
It's better that than closing with it, because that's always just like such a bummer, frankly.
I do got to say, the way he's delivering the lyrics in Watchtower, he does this a couple times in a couple of the songs, but Watchtower in particular, where he just crams like almost an entire verse into one line. There must be some way out of here, cried the Joker to the thief. When she does at the beginning, right. It's fantastic. Like, the first time I heard that when I was listening to this and boning up for the show, like, I literally started laughing just out loud with my fucking AirPods in my
ears. He shoves it all into like the first few seconds and then holds out the last line to make up for it. It's like, it's the same amount of time.
I'm imagining that like your Watchtower would be like a punk or something. Like
Our equivalent song.
The one that shows up, Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa.
You know what's funny? I think Cape Cod is kind of our, like, a pretty typical song three. We come out with, like, a bunch of energy, and then there is some, like, a very familiar moment. And I think for him, I could totally see why. I mean, it's a little bit sad to say, but a significant percentage of that crowd that night, that was the high point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, for sure. It totally. And like we make jokes about like rainy day women on this show.
Mm.
But I'm sure like in the room at the end of the night, like rainy day women like kills. Like,
absolutely.
It would be super fun. And you know, like we would talk about this on my Grateful Dead podcast. Like we would, you know, make jokes about like them doing like Sugar Magnolia at the end of the night, or like doing a Chuck Berry cover. And you have to keep in mind that like what you're listening to on a bootleg is much different than like if you were in the room.
Right. Like,
hearing them do Sugar Magnolia at the end of the night would be awesome. Like you would want that. So, and that's really what your loyalty needs to be to as a performer. It's the audience in the room. Like you're not thinking about like people listening to this like 30 or 40 years later.
Yeah, it's very difficult to cater sets like this to sickos like us that just listen to, we've done a 95 show, 97 show, here's a 94 show, we're going to do another 92 show, and there's Watchtowers in all of them. We're the last thing on his mind at this moment in time, for good reason.
Right, he was probably like, hell yeah. That's when, he knew Joker Man opening at Woodstock 94, okay, good vibe, people are going to be psyched, just like a woman. Great transition, beautiful, but like song three, it's got to be just like a big fat hit.
Yeah.
We tend to drop A-Punk later in the set, but no, but it's the same feeling. You know it's going to be high energy, and also you know that, yeah, it's unfortunate, but it's just how it is. Like, a big group of people, even the most beautiful moment, if you're at anything larger than, like, let's say, like a nice mid-sized theater, which probably is the best place to see a show of anybody.
Sure.
I'm kind of a big believer in that. But anyway, if you're going to play anything even any bigger than that, unfortunately, you could play like the most beautiful version of a quiet song, a ballad, a vibey song. And even if 80% of the crowd was like having an emotional moment, you guys were like, the band and the crowd are in it together. If 20% of the people are kind of checked out, everybody can hear them. You know, maybe the recording, you can like kind of mix it out and years later, it'll be something special. But yeah, you need some firepower after that. You can only do that once or twice. And then it's like, let's get people moving.
He does do, I would say for my Oh Mercy pick, maybe I would throw in Highway 61. I don't know. There's a section of the show that I don't love as much, which is, I guess, like, God knows. I don't think it's my favorite version of... there's versions of God Knows that I, like, really love. This one is fine, and I like that it's here.
I think this one's pretty fire.
It's just, like, a little sloppy, if I'm being, like, real nitpicky.
Yeah, you gotta... Woodstock 94 was sloppy. You gotta get into the mud. That's what this is all about.
Sure.
Mud mindset.
I'm not opposed to the mud. I'm just filling out our negativity section here, so...
I gotta say, like... I'm going to continue my theme of being surprised how much I love hearing Highway 61 Revisited.
Man,
like,
you're riding for life is a highway. You know?
I'm Tom Cochran on this show, man. I'm rocking ass road. That I'm making a deep Tom Cochran reference there, because you just said life is a highway. Ragged ass road. Every time I feel like I'm not going to be in the Highway 61...
They bring you back in.
And then I am.
And you're back on the highway.
Yeah.
You're on the road again.
And sorry. Even Rainy Day Women, which I always make fun of on this show...
Don't tell me you're digging it here.
I literally just edited an episode where you talked shit on it for a while.
I did. And I actually put Rainy Day Women in our Budokan segment, just in the sense of, like, I think I was trying to figure out a way that I could say this is like a radical reinvention, because I actually enjoyed this.
Is it a radical reinvention, or are you just in a better mood?
It's not really.
It's a radical reinvention in Steven's opinion on it.
Yeah. I don't know. I think, like, this whole performance, I was continually amazed. Like, I can't believe Bob delivered at Woodstock 94 like this.
Well, on that note of the Budokan moment, if we want to talk about that.
Which we should clarify is the most radical reinterpretation of a song here. We can't just say Budokan moment and assume everyone understands.
Yeah, the moment that feels like a refreshing twist on a classic that we all know. I would say that I Shall Be Released, for me, was that, not because it's like especially different stylistically, but the thing that is different is this like kind of grotesque guitar soloing
so
by
good.
Bob Dylan, which is very upfront and just and center, and actually like is so triumphantly ugly at times that it's like just really, it was one of the times where I was like just smiling. And there's the triangle.
You gotta love the triangle.
You're saying kind of like good and bad at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a bit of a low point for me that I shall be released. I don't know. Like, I haven't heard that many 90s I shall be released. I just kind of felt like, yeah, you could have done like a pretty version of that song. I don't know. It's kind of the least compelling moment of the show.
Something about the way that Bob plays piano and guitar. If you develop a taste for it, that's when my ears will perk up because of like some plunky, repetitive thing that he's doing. So that's probably just an unpopular opinion that I'm going to put out there.
That's beautiful music to me.
I support it. I support that opinion. I don't totally share it, but I love that Bob decided I'm playing in front of several hundred thousand people. Let's start playing lead guitar. Let's decide now.
Now is the moment.
And there's some real fuck ups. There's like some not particularly confident moments, but it does. There are moments when they all come together. Bob, the lead guitarist, and the pedal steel, not just on Joker Man, and it's really like okay. But yeah, it's kind of feel like he's just like trying to like a little bit and then like backing off and.
He's dipping his toe in, but not completely, not diving in head first.
Well, I just feel like of the tools in Bob Dylan's, you know, toolbox, I feel like lead guitar is like not in the top 10, you know?
Especially lead electric guitar.
Yeah, I feel like, you know.
I just love the bravado to do that, where he's just like, well, this is the occasion where I'd break that out. Like, it's you know, the appropriate time.
He's got to compete with Nine Inch Nails and the fucking light bulb outfit Chili Peppers and Peter Gabriel and stuff. Like, he's got to bring some fireworks, man. He's got to sex it up.
The way he plays, though, just doesn't factor into that choice. He's just like, well, they have guitars.
And you have Green Day.
That's right.
On the opposite stage. And I think it would have been around this time where, like, Billy Joe Armstrong's, like, spitting out mud. Playing all the hits from Dookie.
Literally?
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I think Green Day actually was like a little bit earlier in the day. I feel like they had like a weird set where.
Yeah, definitely daytime.
Yeah, they weren't quite Green Day yet. I think that was like one of the things that helped blow up Dookie. I don't know. I do like to imagine Bob Dylan somehow. Hearing about Green Day on this this day,
I'm like, so curious. I also think Stephen, like you could tell me, paraphrasing you, I kind of remember in something you wrote once about Time Out of Mind, or basically you're talking about some Time Out of Mind or some record after that. You said something like there was some moment in the 90s where Bob Dylan basically became like this like pre rock and roll figure. He became like this timeless ancient one. What were you talking about?
Yeah, just like how he stopped trying to be contemporary. There was this thing in the 80s, like where you could see that he was trying to keep up with like whatever was going on in music. And then at some point he became like the you know, sort of like man with no name.
And you identify that point as being Time Out of Mind, roughly? After,
I mean, I think that, I mean, or you could say like those acoustic records too that he did like in the early 90s, you know, because I think even like Under the Red Sky, you could still say because he had like Slash on that record,
right?
And, you know, like other, you
Hornsby.
Know,
Hornsby, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I guess I'm starting to create a story in my head that, like, and you guys were saying this earlier too, that it's interesting, 94, 3 years out from this, like. Where he fully became that guy. OG, legend, still making deep, relevant music, but totally on his own trip, timeless, you know, man with no name. And I just kind of wonder if maybe this was also a point where he was at his max disconnected from modern music. He was like, he hadn't entered that next phase yet where he could be like, probably feel like, him thinking about Alicia Keys or whatever felt felt like grandfatherly, but he also was done with trying to keep up. I'm picturing him just being like I wonder if Bob like was like checking out new bands, listening to Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Green Day, whatever. Or I wonder if this is a moment where he just started to be like, I don't give
a
shit.
He was apparently like kind of dialed into some stuff. There's some apocryphal story for the Time Out of Mind shit that I remember came up recently with all the Fragment stuff. Steven, you might have come across this given the fact that you wrote the fucking liner notes, but he was into Odelay, the Beck record in 96, and the fact that Beck was doing all that like on tape loops inspired him to try to do tape loop shit on Time Out of Mind, and the closest thing that you get to on that is Dirt Road Blues, which sort of works, at least the original version of it. I think he was like, I don't know if the contemporary shit was like making itself known in the way that his music sounded, especially live at this time necessarily. Although someone like Winston does sound very like, 90s, at this moment. But, I do think he was kind of like, he has been and always has been kind of aware of what the big kind of new currents were out there in the world. Whether or not he would admit it, another question.
Yeah, I mean, I think from like a live perspective, he was aware of it just because he was playing this sort of like overtly rock type show. I think he was trying to appeal to people on that level. But I think in 94, I kind of feel like he didn't yet realize that he was going to have another songwriting life.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was still the period where he felt like, maybe I'm done as a songwriter and I'm just going to play my songs on the road.
Well, something that occurred to me was that this is the year right after the big 30th anniversary show.
Mm.
Right? Was that 93?
That was 92.
92.
At the Garden with Sinead?
Yeah, his big all-star event.
A cavalcade of stars.
Which is, we don't need to talk about how good or bad that is. But what it is, I think it probably was like a confidence booster. I mean, come on. Like, it was a huge deal where all these people went out of their way and in this big public function and that he was a legend, like a living legend. It did a lot probably to help solidify that. I wonder if that tribute show maybe did something to like sort of put wind in his sails.
I mean, my memory at the time was that Bob Dylan was like pretty irrelevant.
Pretty irrelevant.
Early 90s. Irrelevant. Yeah, like, especially compared to like Neil Young. Like Neil Young was super, I think, keyed into like what alternative rock was. And Bob Dylan was like pretty removed, and Neil Young was putting out all these records of like original songs that were connecting with people, and Dylan really wasn't writing anything at that time. So,
and his boy Tom Petty crushing it.
Yeah, Petty That's is right. crushing it. Like Petty and Neil Young felt contemporary in a way that like Dylan didn't. I think Dylan felt more like a historical figure, which is why you have the greatest hits nature of this Woodstock 94 set and like the MTV Unplugged and the Greatest Hits Volume 3 coming out. I feel like it was more about his ability to interpret his past at this time, and like he did a great job. Like, this performance is great, MTV Unplugged is great. But I don't think there was any, I don't think there was any feeling that like he's gonna write great songs again. That didn't really seem plausible in 94.
And maybe he was in the middle of figuring out that next. He was probably, wait, so with 94 he's 50 what? 53. So I bet he's probably looking around just realizing like, okay, I'm not gonna have a keep on rocking in the free world moment. He'd already like kind of passed through his 40s. Probably also is like, I'm not gonna have like a, even though I know he famously had like mixed feelings about Paul Simon, he probably was like, I'm not gonna have a Graceland where like right. I figure out this way to be like a mature dude who still makes a monster album, that kind of whatever. So maybe he started to look like, well, yeah, what can I be? And he was like, be like spooky old timeless man, like, and he did it.
If we want to read into that thing, that comment he made to Winston Watson, allegedly, it's like him saying that if it has some significance, that you make me feel like I can do anything up there, that maybe says something about where he's at, his head's at. It's like, I want to just be able to rock and rock really well and do it like as good as these other people who are a lot younger than me and just pull it off again like I used to do. And I think that that's maybe what he was trying to communicate there. It was like, that is what he's able to do at this point. It actually is true that like he goes up there and holds his own against bands, you know, half his age.
I just want to be able to rock and roll, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, no new songs yet. But this is just a random thought that I had. But to me, God knows, that's just exactly, if John Lennon had lived, that's exactly the type of song he would have written in the early 90s. Of course, he'd be coming at it from a different angle in terms of his relationship with God. But just because it has those like slight John Lennon chords, I could just picture that like John Lennon Woodstock 94 solo performance. Wow. Bust that out. And you're kind of like, you know what? This song's decent, actually.
Yeah, it works.
I don't know. It has such a what if sound to me.
I see that.
I love that.
A late John Lennon.
It also has that James Bond quality where it's like down, 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 down.
And that's also why it's fun, because like Joker Man and God Knows, they're not just like blues rocker vibes, you know, harmonically. There's something about them. It's just like it's sits in its own category.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, like Highway 61 Revisited, it's more about the band than whatever like Dylan is doing. But yeah, it's really interesting like, with him, like where he was at. I do like the idea of this kind of being the beginning of him maybe starting to realize like what his second life is going to be. I don't think he had quite taken that turn yet. Because, you know, you have, like, Jerry dying in 95. Mm. That seems like that was, like, a big inspiration for, like, Time Out of Mind. And, yeah, it's an interesting point in his career. Because I do feel like as, like, a live performer, he was totally at a peak.
Definitely. I think it's significant just on the note of him, you know, transitioning and becoming these different personas and stuff. Like, because he gets to the Time Out of Mind thing, and that's when he kind of steps into this old soul of the rock world. And then that only lasts for a couple years. And then once he makes his next move after that, like 2001 era going into Love and Theft, like that's when he fully just detaches from time and becomes a historical spirit in corporeal form, where, you know, 94 or early 90s grunge kind of shit, like it makes sense that someone like Neil had more relevance at that time, right? Because Neil's music was more relevant to the people that made the music that was popular. Like Neil was a much more direct kind of connection to like Pearl Jam, obviously, or Nirvana. And Bob, you know, was not really kind of on vogue at that moment with the cutting edge wave of rockers. And so I think that ends up informing like what choices he makes, where like you fast forward to 2001, like that's the return of rock era, right? The Strokes, White Stripes, Vines, Hives, all those bands. And like Bob doesn't really, like there's no connection to that group of bands whatsoever for Bob Dylan.
But he loves Julian Casablanca, he says.
Casablanca,
that's right. Yeah. I have to imagine that was a typo more so than that was him saying Casablanca. But, you know, who's...
Isn't that,
you know,
also just like the type of thing he would do, though?
Yeah, yeah, it just does
purposefully,
sound like
he knows it's Casablanca, but purposefully say Casablanca. Well, but that's what I'm saying. It's like he, you know, those band, he might like them or he might claim to like them, but like his influence on them is really nil.
He's not
basically
trying to keep up
but
with the Claxons in 2000.
He's not, yeah, exactly. He's not running a risk of being historically irrelevant based on whatever version of rock music is in fashion at a given time, when he decides to, like I said, do this Love and Theft thing and completely just detach from the present and become this historical geist, basically.
Mm. And that ends up, you know, corresponding really well like with the internet, you know, like where time really become, you know, like the idea of like movements and music becomes less of a thing, like where, you know, like this thing comes in and it wipes out everything else, and then this other thing comes in and it wipes out everything else. You know, like we live in a world now like where a lot of different things coexist at the same time.
He sees the future.
So we reach the part where we need to do the bootleg name.
Oh, right, like a pun.
We always like to come up with the worst possible
fan bootleg title.
Bob's Boots titles.
Yeah, so should I go first?
You got one?
So I was thinking, obviously, Woodstock here, different kind of Woodstock references. Back to the Garden. But not Back to the Garden. All right. I'm going to do Bob to the Garden.
Bob to the Garden. That's perfect, actually, because it is dog shit. That's exactly so, what I figured, those kind of people would come up with.
Thank you. I was trying to come up with this Bob to the Garden as the stupidest thing.
All along Woodstock Tower.
Okay.
Love it.
I think that's a little too cutesy.
Okay, then Stock Nose.
I've got, so this was, this Woodstock took place at a Winston farm in upstate New York, right? This was where it was supposed to, the original Woodstock was supposed to have taken place in 1969, and then they ended up, you know, those guys backed out, and someone else, there's that Justin Long movie about it or whatever. So this set took, or the whole festival at Winston Farm. Who do we have playing in Bob Dylan's band but Winston Watson?
Oh, no. Mm. I see where this is going.
Ain't gonna play on Winston's farm no more. Which, unfortunately, like, if only he had played Maggie's Farm at this one, that would have sealed the deal. But that was just too good for me to let sitting there.
Ezra, do you have a terrible name, or do you want to sit this one out?
I mean, I could just continue down the subbing Woodstock in for every song on the set list. I do think they're just like a Woodstock. Just like, pretty bad. Yeah. So you were saying it was muddy, so does Rainy Day Woodstock
work? There you go, yeah.
Numbers 90 and 4.
Yeah, what is the number 90? Oh, yeah, that's it. Rainy Day Woodstock number 90 and 4.
Joker Stock?
Yeah.
Joker stock.
Sure.
No, I'm sorry. That wasn't very good. I'm gonna stick with Bob to the Garden.
I think Bob to the Garden. That takes the cake for me.
Got to get ourselves back to the Garden.
So, early Roman King, our MVP of this show.
I feel like we've already kind of set. I mean, it's Winston for me, just because that's it. There's such a spiritual and a beautiful moment shared between them. It seems to supercharge the beginning of this whole show.
It's hard to top that little nugget of trivia. I got to agree.
So I'm gonna say someone who does not get a lot of credit on our show, even though he plays every show.
This is my pick too.
Tony Garnier, yes. Because of the drone-y
stand-up bass, the bow.
Yeah.
Where he's like alienating the entire crowd. I love it. Tony Garnier is my early Roman King of the show.
You're going to get that's a second for me on Tony being the early Roman King. You know what? I'm even going to give him the Diamond Joe. The just invented Diamond Joe. Diamond Joe.
The
moniker.
Coveted Diamond Joe award.
He also looked incredible in this like really kind of baggy blue suit with the classic Tony hat at that moment. I think JJ Jackson was also wearing what seemed to be like a matching baggy blue suit. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but the whole vibe of all these guys on stage. Winston's in the shirtless vest. Bucky's got it like a David Foster Wallace bandana going. It's a really incredible just island of misfit toys up there on stage.
Island of cool guys.
That's right. You got an early Roman King, Ezra, an MVP of the band.
I'm kind of surprised I'm the only one, but for me, it was all about Bucky Baxter.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I just thought he brought so much flavor, and, like, I really think about, you know, he's a multi-instrumentalist, and there was something about the acoustic numbers, him on mandolin, it just felt so good. For me, it felt so 1994. Like, those are those moments where I felt like you could get, like, the 90s neo-hippies and everybody coming together and feeling good. And just when you think about it, like, you know, maybe he could have just been a pedal steel guy, but he's come up, kind of like bring some nice rhythm on there. So yeah, I really felt like he kind of, for me, he glued it all together. I mean, the band was great, but that's what and especially for, I also got to plead ignorance a little bit. I've heard so few. I'm sitting around listening to 90s Bob bootlegs often, I'm sad to say. So when I'm just like focusing in on this show, of hearing Pedal Steel on Joker Man, hearing Mandolin on Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, those are those instrumental things that really stood out to me. And I was like, hell yeah, who is totally. This dude? Then I was like looking him up. I was sad to see he died kind of young and said he released an album. I couldn't find it. As I was like kind of driving around today being like, I want to listen to Bucky Baxter's solo material if I can find it before the podcast.
Did you?
No, I searched him on Apple Music and he came up on some other things. What I read on Wikipedia seemed to imply that there was a Bucky Baxter album. There's a...
Oh yeah, I see this, 1999, Most Likely No Problem.
Yeah, that's not on Apple Music. Let's see if it's on Spotify. Steven, you don't have that on CD?
No, I don't. I was just looking up his... he has a son who's like a singer-songwriter too. Raylan Baxter.
Oh, Raylan Baxter?
Yeah.
That's great.
Which I listened, I heard one of his albums. I don't have Bucky Baxter's album on CD. I feel like I should.
It's not
it
streaming.
Seems like a hole in the collection. I just pulled up a Bucky Baxter song off this album called The Big Difficult. Features another Never Ending Stories personality that we've come back to again. Your boy Ian Wallace on the kit, Steven.
And also just with the context, was he was part of the band all through the 90s?
Good chunk.
For like,
he left...
Like in the middle
left,
of the 90s.
He left when, and Larry came in 97, right? Like the right before Time Out of Mind dropped.
Like the meat of the 90s, he was there. And like his Pedal Steel sound, I think, is so definitive for Bob Dylan live stuff in the middle of the decade. So what's the star rating?
Ooh.
For this show? I gotta say, okay, I'm gonna throw down the gauntlet for this. I'm going to go 3 stars.
Beautiful.
For this show. I'm throwing out the 3 stars for this. And maybe it's...
Out of 5?
Out of 3.
Out of 3.
Okay.
It's the way we do things around here.
It's the patented system.
I think this is a great show. I really... And it's one of those shows where the set list... it's a greatest hits set list, so... That's definitely like a mark against it on some level, but I think it's so well done and it's like on such a big stage. I think he really pulls it up. I love this show. So I'm going 3 stars.
Incredible.
Yeah.
I was waiting for you.
Once you told me that little anecdote about Winston and Bob at the beginning, I was just like, automatically 3 stars. That's the sweetest thing I've ever heard.
Isn't it so sweet?
That's beautiful.
It seems like Bob was like... It seemed like Bob and Winston had like a good relationship. I don't know. It was very... It didn't end well. It seems like Bob can't fire people in a very ethical way. It always ends poorly with his side
men.
Gets
messy.
But, I don't know. It doesn't seem like Winston has any ill will toward him. It's a very good relationship.
He got to be on... He was the MTV Unplugged, too. Like, he's really prominently featured in the lore and, like, the people who know. Like, he might be the one drummer you do know of the Never Ending Tour. And rightfully so, for some great playing.
How many stars, Ezra?
Can you do decimal points?
It's like the Michelin Guide.
See, okay. Also the system I've introduced where... The parentheses, you can do like a
half
star.
Works pretty well for a Michelin guide just to do 1 to 3.
You've stumbled across a point of contention on the podcast, as you might be able to tell.
Look, if we're going Michelin rules, I'm going to give it 3 stars because just like if you like a restaurant, you're the Michelin critic, you don't want to hold back. Give them the 3 stars so that they'll get butts in the seats.
It's fantastic.
You know? So that's what I'm going to do for this show. 3 stars. Check it out. Enjoy.
I'm not going to disagree.
Head over
That's
there.
A straight 4, quadruple 3-star.
Plan a vacation. Fly the family out and watch
up
this
to
show.
The Socrates.
Yeah, it's worth traveling for. 3 stars.
Well, that's great. I really appreciate that that explanation of how the star system works. I couldn't have done it better. That is really.
I know you've totally justified Evan there by totally rejecting the parentheses system.
He's going to be dining out on that for months.
You know, I guess you could also compare it to like tipping, where if something was ballpark good service, a lot of people say, and I think I agree with them, 20%. Sure. Don't start nickel and diming. That's more of an when you get it on like the iPad, it's like 15%, not bad. 18%, really good. 20%, incredible. It's just like either it's something where you're like this is not a tipping situation, and you're gonna go down for some reason, or I'll just do a dollar, or it's go straight up to 20 or higher. Depending on the situation.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Be happy with what you get. It's Bob Dylan playing Bob Dylan music at Woodstock. Does it get any better than that, folks?
20% tip for Bob at 94. Woodstock 94. I think that 20% totally makes sense.
Yeah. I'm slamming that top like green smiley face in the bathroom or at the checkout.
Oh, right.
Like, where it's, the satisfaction is, yeah, I'm satisfied.
As happy as it gets.
I'm so happy.
Ezra, thank you so much for suggesting this show. Again, I would not have listened to this, I think, for many years if you hadn't have brought this up, so I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for you for coming on. It's been great.
I had a blast. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
We couldn't have had a better first official guest on the program.
I really appreciate it. Very, very happy to be here. It really was meant to be because I'm a big Bob fan, but I'm in a place in my Bob journey where I'm still contemplating Tempest and listening to Brownsville Girl for the 100th time,
studying the Talmud.
Yeah, I'm catching up. I'm getting deeper into the records. When I was just like a casual fan, I didn't know that well. So anyway, that's all to say, I don't know that much about live Bob, and it just so happened this is this one show I've had bookmarked, and it actually is one that I'd great to talk to you guys about and hear your perspective on too, because I did see Bob at the Pantages last year, and that was one of the, I know that you guys have all been huge fans of that tour, and that was my previous experiences seeing Bob had been kind of chaotic and disorienting, and then I saw that and I was just like so blown away.
Those were amazing shows.
Yeah, really.
I'm the only one who hasn't seen this tour
just
yet.
Just go to Japan.
Yeah, exactly.
I live in literally his home state. I think he will be here this summer. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. So
right. We'll get in touch with your buddy Jeff Rose and see if he can swing him up through Minnesota. Thank you again, Ezra. This was truly fantastic. Folks out there, you don't need us to say it, but listen to Vampire Week and listen to Time Crisis, which is coming back from what I've seen on Twitter. Is that right?
Yeah, we had a little a couple-month break. We'll be back at the beginning of March. Apple Music, they sponsored the wonderful Rihanna Super Bowl halftime show.
There you go.
So the programming went a little.
Yeah. When's the Vampire Weekend halftime show? Like, when can we see this? Is this gonna be 2020?
I think the era of bands first of all, I don't think we'd ever be in consideration. But even the big bands, the Who, the Springsteen, I just think that era is over. Can you picture just like a rock band at the Super Bowl, just like doing a set? It makes a lot more sense. A solo artist who can be on a platform. I'm not complaining. I just think it's that. Yeah.
You wouldn't be up there like on those flying platforms, like getting down and like dancing in front of the camera and stuff.
You can't do that with a band. You need one iconic person. Maybe, I don't know if you have to be Canadian to play what do you call the Canadian football Super Bowl?
The Maple Cup.
I'm just picturing like U2, Lil Yachty, and Bad Bunny. That can be a halftime
all together
next year. We can package it together early 2000s style, like when they
Aerosmith
and Christina Aguilera.
Bob Dylan, Vampire Weekend, Mountain Brews.
Sort of that'd be medley. Legendary.
That would be nice.
That would, yeah, that's a better medley.
Next year in Jerusalem.
I'll reach out to the NFL.
Till next time.
Don't you dare miss it.
Thanks, everybody!
Bob Dylan was here last time we played, so we thought it's appropriate. We love you so much. Here's Joker Man.
Look into the fire to see the rich man without any name.